Zo, hallo lieve luisteraar. We zijn in de MKZ. En het is een repaircafé vandaag. Er is iets revolutionairs gebeurd. Mijn fiets is gerepareerd. Ik heb maandenlang met een kapot achterlicht gereden. En die is dankzij de inzet van Peter.
My name is Evgeny Morozov, and I'll be your host. Welcome back to the Santiago Boys, a podcast about a group of radical engineers, engineers who are helping Salvador Allende, the Chilean president, to build his socialist dream. And they're doing it with computers and cybernetics, but...
Ja, willkommen zu unserer Sendung Demokratie, Fragezeichen. Demokratie ist ja, wir leben in der besten Demokratie überhaupt und das wird ja immer so dargestellt, als ob es gar nicht besser ginge und es kann auch geschichtlich nichts Besseres mehr kommen. Unter diesen Voraussetzungen, ich habe jetzt Micha von Freiheitsfu in der Leitung, hallo.
Ja, hallo, guten Abend.
Was ist denn Freiheitsfu überhaupt?
Factories. I'm going to date myself. I remember it was the Congress around 1990 or 1991 or so, where I was sitting together with some people who came over to the States to visit the CCC Congress, and we were kind of riffing on how great the internet is going to make the world. You know, how it's going to bring world peace and truth will rule and everything like that. Boy, were we naive. Boy, were we totally wrong. And today, I'm going to be schooled in how wrong I actually was, because we have Svea, Dennis, and Philip to tell us all about the fake-like factories around the world. And with that, could you please help me in welcoming them onto the stage? Svea, Dennis, and Philip. Thank you very much.
Yeah, welcome to our talk, Inside the Fake-Like Factories. So, my name is Philip. I'm an internet activist against disinformation, and I'm also a student of the University of Bamberg.
Hi, thank you that you, yeah, that you listened to us tonight. My name is Svea. I'm an
less flying insects in 25 years. It's supposedly dropping at around about 2.5 a year. Now, we need insects much more than they need us. They are the glue layer of our food system, but within the planetary boundary and biological sense, they are absolutely intrinsic. They also keep much of our water very fresh. As one biologist put it, we humans will never see the end of the insects. We need them that much. Now, climate change has become very much the ascribed to this this loss of species, but in fact, it's not climate change that is responsible for species decline per se. The WWF's Living Planet Index attributes about 7% of species declines to warming. In fact, the real reason why we are losing so many species so quickly is because we're changing their habitats or just removing them entirely. And certainly urbanization is a part of that, and land change as a result of warming, but primarily it's because we've replaced habitats with farmland. This is, for instance, in the Amazon basin.
Thank you. one time a crazy dream came to me. I dressed up swapping a world old tree. I went to the doctor's bar next day to see what kind of words he had to say. He said it was a bad dream. I said, hold it, Doc, a world war passed through my brain. He said, nurse, get your pad, the boy's obviously insane. He grabbed my arm and I said, ouch, as I landed on the psychiatric couch. He said, tell me about it, your dream. Well, the whole thing started at 3 o'clock fast. It was all over by 4:15. I was down in the sewer with some little lover when I peeked out from a manhole cover wondering who turned the lights on. Well, I got up and I walked around, up and down the lonesome town, just wondering which way to go. I lit a cigarette on a parking meter, walked on down the road. It was a normal day. Well, I rung me a fallout shelter bell and I leaned my head and I give a big yell. Give me a TV dinner, I'm a hungry man. A shotgun fired and away I ran. I don't blame him much though, he didn't know me. Down the corner by the hot dog stand, I seen another man. I said, howdy friend, I guess it's just us two. He screamed, down the road he flew. Thought I was a communist. Well, I grabbed me a girl before she could leave. I said, let's go play Adam and Eve. I took her by the hand and my heart was thumbing. She said, hey man, are you crazy or something? You seen what happened last time this started? Well, I remember seeing some newspaper ads, so I turned on my Conrad. But I didn't pay the Con Ed bill, so the radio didn't work so well. I turned on a record player. It was Martha and the Vandellas. Talking about leader of the pack. I seen me a Cadillac window uptown. There was nobody around. I got into the driver's seat and I drove down 42nd Street in my Cadillac. Good car to drive after a war. By that time I was feeling blue and needed somebody to talk to. So I called up the operator of time just to hear a voice of some kind. She said, when you hear the beep, it'll be 3 o'clock. She said that for over an hour and I hung up. Well, the doctor interrupted me just about then, saying I've been having the same old dream, but mine's different, don't you see? I dreamt the only person left after the war was me. I didn't see you around, or nobody looks like you. Time passed and now it seems everybody's having them dreams. Everybody sees himself walking around with no one else. Well, some of the people can be part right all of the time. All the people can be some right part of the time. Part of the people can be some right all of the time. But all of the people can't be all right all of the time. Carl Sandburg said that. let you be in my dream if I can be in your dream. I said that.
Welcome to Crosstalk, where all things are considered. I'm Peter Lavelle. We are told one of the hallmarks of Western liberalism is the idea and practice of tolerance. More specifically, it is said we should not judge an individual or group based on their race, color, or creed. But that apparently doesn't apply when it comes to Russians. Russophobia is the new bigotry. Crosstalking Russophobia, I'm joined by my guest, Arthur Clearoux in Toronto. He is a liberty advocate and freelance editor. In Ojai, we have Oliver Boyd Barrett. He is a professor emeritus of journalism and public relations at Bowling Green State University, as well as author of Russiagate and Propaganda. And here in Moscow, we cross to Robert Bridge. He's an American writer and journalist based in Moscow. All right, gentlemen, Crosstalk rules in effect. That means you can jump in anytime you want, and I always appreciate it. Arthur, let me go to you first in Toronto. What happened to the liberal tradition? I mean, it seems they've all crashed. I mean, every single minority group, marginalized group, we have to have tolerance. We hear it all the time, 24/7. But there's one exception. It's Russians, apparently. Go ahead in Toronto.
It's interesting because there's almost a rejection of that original liberalism that the West kind of developed over the last little while. And it's turned into a new religion. A new state religion, almost, in which there's something called a repressive tolerance. And that is based in this kind of neo-Marxian postmodern ideology that is very rampant throughout the West in general.
Yeah, oh, that's what it gets down to. Oliver, if I can go to you very early in California, you specialize in these kinds of things here. Are you surprised of the ferociousness of this kind of cancel campaign? I mean, this is a canceling of an entire people, of an entire culture. Now, only a few weeks ago, months ago, we don't like this government, but we like the people. They don't even apply that now. Go ahead, Oliver.
Yes, I am somewhat surprised by the veracity of it. There's nothing new about Russophobia, of course. It's gone back I would put it at least as far back as the Crimean War of 1853 and probably from before then. And then, of course, we saw that through the Bolshevik Revolution and the long era of the Cold War. When we came out of the Cold War, we were to discover that apparently communism or the absence of communism had actually nothing to do with U.S.-Russian relations, but that we still had to keep thinking negatively about Russia. But here's the thing, I would say, Peter, is that when it comes, every nation has got its black periods. Some nations have got lots of black periods, but the Western media, Western establishment thought usually allows some light onto these otherwise black periods, despite the fact of the treatment of Native Americans, the issue of slavery in the United States. Nonetheless, in our histories, in the media histories of the United States, these things do not loom too large. But in the case of Russia, no light is allowed. And there you have the death, really, of liberalism and liberal thought.
Let's go to Robert here in Moscow. I mean, Robert, if you don't mind me saying, I mean, you do have a Russian family, you have a Russian wife, you have children that, depending on how you want to describe it, Russian-American or American-Russian, I don't know. This must be very painful for you because, you know, you and I have lived here for a very long time. One of the oddities of this Russophobia is you and I, as Americans living in Russia, we feel no discrimination against, no anxiety, no hatred whatsoever. Zero, okay? But, you know, when you look at, you know, in the West, you have this demonization of an entire population of people, its culture and its civilization. It's something I've never seen before on this scale. Go ahead, Robert.
Yeah, what does surprise me, Peter, is that the hatred, it doesn't seem to really be coming from the grassroots level. I know Russians in America, and they're getting along fine with their neighbors, although there are, of course, exceptions to that rule. But in general, it seems to be that the pressure is coming from the top, from the governments and the corporations and organizations, the ones who should be really discouraging this type of, let's just call it racist attitude. For example, you have in the United Kingdom, the sports minister there, he just suggested that Russian players, they'll have to, if they wish to participate in Wimbledon in the summer, they may have to publicly disavow Vladimir Putin. I mean, this is like this type of humiliating arm twisting that they're doing, this political meddling. It even invaded the world of chess, for example. Now the Russian chess players, they want to get out of the European chess union. They want to join the Asian chess union. They don't want to put up with this. They don't want to have to tolerate such a thing. You can't blame them. And what is so striking, I think, about this type of behavior is that you didn't see this type of cancel culture virtue signaling when George Bush, for example, was bombing Iraq, or Barack Obama was bombing Libya. You didn't have any corporations leaving the United States. You didn't have them boycotting products. You didn't have them walking out. You didn't have McDonald's closing. And you could really make the argument, too, that Russia has a real justification. They've been warning the West now for many years, decades, about NATO advancement. They've been warning for 8 years about the bombing of the Donbass, about killing of Russian speakers there. But it just continues. And so the hypocrisy is just off the charts. And
but Robert, you know, you're putting context into this, and that's what you're not allowed to do. No context allowed, okay? You gave it some context here. Let's go back to Arthur here. Because it's not about politics. It's about a people. It's the nature of these people. That's what this is all about. That's what racism is all about here. This liberal mindset can't even comprehend that they are propagating racism against a large group of people. Collective guilt. Go ahead, in Toronto.
Well, it goes back to what I was bringing up at the very beginning. That whole concept, that ideology, that is, what we have to realize is the West is not a liberal democracy at this point in time. We are infected with an ideology that is nothing like liberal democracy. And it does see people as either oppressors or oppressed. And in this case, it sees Russia as the oppressor. Therefore, Russia and its people, and it doesn't even matter who or what or nuance or anything like that, canceled, done. And when we realize that the West is doing it to itself as well, there's almost no Western country I know of that isn't practicing the same sort of cancellation, the same sort of antagonism towards people within its own borders. It's surprising. It was amazing to see that they could do it at such a broad scale to an entire country. But this is something that most of us who are champions of liberty in any sort of way have been fighting against for almost a decade now.
Okay, Oliver, I mean, there's an obvious historical analog here, and it's McCarthyism. And I would say that it's far worse now, because McCarthyism was ideologically driven. It was about an ideology. It was about communism. It wasn't about a people, per se. In this case, it is. So this is a new McCarthyism that propagates bigotry and racism. Your thoughts. Go ahead.
Yes, I think I agree with you that probably this is even worse than the McCarthy era. Back then, there was not a hot war between the Soviet Union and the United States. I would argue, despite pretenses to the contrary, I would argue that now there is a hot war. A hot war has actually broken out between the United States, NATO, NATO and Russia. So that is a huge difference. Back then, there was a real anxiety and concern about the power of nuclear weapons, but nobody was expecting that nuclear weapons would start being used there and then. Whereas right now, if we're not worried and concerned that nuclear weapons could be used, whether intentionally or as a result of some kind of miscalculation or accident, then we are being extremely foolish. That is the reality that greater than at any other time of my life. I was born in 1945, after the one great classic case of nuclear weapons being used by the United States to finish off what it claimed it needed to use the nuclear weapons to finish off World War II, to finish off Japan, although I think many historians would say they were not necessary and their use was not justifiable at that time. And they didn't help to bring about the end of the war, because that was above.
Yeah, but that begs the point, Robert, if I can go back to you here. I mean, so banning people, Russians, from participating in the Boston Marathon, you already mentioned chess. We have musicians. How does that change anything? How does that change the political calculus, except for punishing individuals because of the way they were born? Go ahead.
Yeah, it really doesn't change anything, Peter. It's just basically, as you said, it's a form of racism. The vilification, and this whole cult, we're really caught up in a new wave of some kind of insanity from the West. This whole cancel culture. You know, you can vilify white people, for example, come right out and talk negatively about them. You can have critical race theory now that promotes this whole idea that underlines this whole another form of racism. So when you look at Russia and how they're going to be able to rank in terms of such an ideology that's taken over much of the West, it's just getting worse and worse every day. You can't criticize anything. You can't speak out against anything. Even comedy has died in the West. You know, yesterday was Black Lives Matter. And, you know, despite the fact that group was torching neighborhoods across the nation, that was deemed okay. You know, today it's, there are participants of the January 6th in so-called insurrection sitting in prison right now. And Hollywood celebrities aren't about to bail them out like they bailed out the BLM protest. So I'm just giving like the background of this, and Russia, the way it is, the fact that it's such a convenient scapegoat for so much wrong in the West, it's a nice distant enemy, so to speak, that they can point to a scapegoat. They're not going to fare very well in this new type of ideology that just wants to. It's like an inquisition, really. Yeah. And Russia's the perfect target for this. It's been building up for a long time in Hollywood. Russia has always been the bad guy. It's always been the villain. And now you have it when you have this particular conflict.
Well,
that Russia
there is downside from this, and we're going to discuss that in the second part of the program. All right, gentlemen, I'm going to jump in here. We're going to go to a short break, and after that short break, we'll continue our discussion on Russophobia. Stay with RT. Welcome back to Crosstalk, where all things are considered. I'm Peter Lavelle. To remind you, we're discussing Russophobia. Okay, let's go back to Toronto. I can't believe a case is being made on a massive scale with the entire corporate media behind it, the entire political class. They're trying to convince us, in so many words, that this world will be better without Dostoevsky, Gogol, Tchaikovsky, et cetera, et cetera. How can they make that case? Go ahead. I'm mystified.
Well, I mean, again, going back to what we've been dealing with here in the West for the last 10 years, they've been making that case against Shakespeare.
Yeah.
They've been making that case against Churchill, or against Thomas Jefferson or George Washington. It's not, once you're going after your own founding fathers, it's not difficult to
good point.
To cancel an other. But it's interesting. What I find even more, and I think it should be terrifying for anyone over on this side of the world, is the ease at which they're able to circle the wagons and cancel something as vast as a country. When you have any sort of monolith like that, whether it's in a corporation or a government or anything, you're facing problems even without the geopolitical aspect. You're facing problems just for lack of competition, lack of good ideas, lack of fresh anything. So it's really an issue, and we're going to be feeling it. I mean, we already are feeling it on our side of the world right now, as far as economic kick, what do you call it, backlash from our own sanctions.
Yeah, there's sometimes, always, you can't unring a bell, and I think we're going to be faced with that. Oliver, you said the origins of Russophobia, you can go back to the Crimean War. I would even go further. I would go to the Napoleonic Wars, but it doesn't really make any difference. It's interesting to me that if we go back to the Napoleonic Wars to the present, we've had different types of political environments, different governments, regimes, all kind of ideology, everything you can imagine. But the Russophobia just stays the same. It never really changes. It's really quite remarkable, okay? My question to you is here, I talked about the antecedents here, but I'd like to go something much more immediate, and that's Russiagate. And it seems to me, and Robert's already brought it up here, this is still the kind of the revenge for 2016. Because it's very convenient, it's easy to rally the forces, it's easy to intimidate progressives, importantly. Russiagate was a very important thing to get the progressives under control. And now we just have an extension of it because it's the only tool in the toolbox. Go ahead.
Yes, interesting how propaganda is very difficult to kill a propaganda campaign. And in fact, when we come to Russia, it's very useful not to or to prevent previous propaganda campaigns from dying out completely. So because it just makes it so easy to build on previous propaganda campaigns, in this instance, against Russia or against the Soviet Union, your population is already riled up against your chosen enemy. And it's just so convenient to be able to remind them of that that residual anger or fear that they have from the previous propaganda campaign, and then to exploit that for whatever it is whatever your current purposes are. The most interesting thing about Russiagate, of course, is that it had virtually nothing to do with Russia.
Absolutely right. Absolutely
it had everything to do with the Democratic Party, in whose interest it was propagated. And now we still find, even within the last few days, further revelations from the John Durham investigation. So we got three threads of different kinds of lies that are being told in Russiagate. First of all, that Trump is in some way or was in some way beholden to Vladimir Putin. That's the basic lie of the now undermined Steele report. Yeah. And then we got the lie about Russia being somehow in cahoots with a Russian bank, the Alpha Bank. That is being demolished as we speak. And then we have the whole lie about Russian intelligence hacking the computers of the Democratic campaign. And as a result of the supposed investigations
I have another question for you, Oliver. Okay, so let's just think back of all of the reports on CNN, MSNBC, even Fox, you know, BBC, of all the reports on Russiagate. Do you think that they should actually be deleted because they were misinformation? Because 17 years of my work was disappeared, okay? I mean, there's a very interesting double standard here. Let me go to Robert here. You know, Robert, one of the interesting things is that I think you've also noticed living here is that the West lives in its own echo chamber all of the time in its ideology, because all of the Russophobic statements that are made in the West are just televised here in Moscow. The average Russian sees exactly what the West thinks of them as a people and a country. I wonder what effect that will have, because as I have said, and I'm always considered a bit of a hardliner, they don't like you, they want to destroy you, and now I have ample evidence, 24/7, of evidence of what I've been saying for years. Take it away, Robert.
Yeah, that's true. And I feel bad for all these companies that did leave Moscow and Russia, and they left behind a huge market. And I think a lot of them, I mean, I'm just speaking about the economic point of view here, they think that they're going to come back and that the Russians are just going to be so happy again to be able to eat their Big Macs and French fries again, and they're going to all be back again in line.
Nope.
But I think they're going to be mistaken. There's apparently they're still paying the rent on their property. They're still paying the employees, at least I think they are. I hope they are. But I think when they try to come back here, they're going to be in for a rude awakening from the Russian public that, you know, they see this blatant hypocrisy, this real hatred, it's just nasty. And I even wonder, I'm sorry for speaking about the economic side of it, but you even have to wonder if Russia's thinking if it's even worth having these big corporations here. They're just going to snub you. Russia's trying to enforce its own foreign policy, and it's being held hostage by these corporations who come here, make a buck. And then when things get tough, when they don't like what Putin does, they say, oh, I'm sorry, we're going to close up shop now. We're going to come back when things are a little bit cooled off. Well, I can't wait to see how that's going to work, how this is going to pan out the next time America decides to bomb somebody. And what happens then? Are these corporations going to close up their shops there in the West, in the European capitals? Somehow, I don't think so.
You know, it's interesting, Arthur, is that, again, you know, the West having its own echo chamber, because they don't realize how much they alienate people around the world, particularly in the case that we're talking about in Russia. Being talked down to and being besmirched like that, it really hurts hard. Because, you know, to give a little bit of context, which I know Western media doesn't like to do, is that in the Donbass for 8 years, up to 14,000 people were killed. They were basically ethnic Russians. Nobody pulled a Starbucks out of anywhere because of that, okay? As a matter of fact, most publics in the West have never even heard of the Donbass until February 24th. That's very insulting to people that have lost lives and family. Go ahead in Toronto.
Of course. Of course. Well, there's, in the West right now, for anyone who has half a brain, there's a crisis going on. And it's a crisis of trust in basically every institution, but journalism and media have been at the center of this crisis for a very long time, probably longer than even we're aware of. You know, it's the same story as what happened with Syria. In 2014, all of a sudden, people who had no idea where Syria was on a map and never heard of someone named Assad prior to that, all of a sudden knew exactly what Syria needed and exactly who this man was and how bad he was. And it's the same thing. They didn't hear when things started to heat up here in Canada, for example, about the Russian incursion into Ukraine. At the same time, Yemen was being bombed. It's been being bombed for years now. We don't know. The average Canadian has no idea that that's happening. The average American probably has no idea either, yet we are sponsoring that. So it's a matter of that spotlight. Where is that spotlight being shown? And at this point in time, because you have that coordinated effort, they shine the spotlight where they want your attention to go.
Well, let's go to Oliver. I'll tell you one thing they don't want to talk about, and Robert and I have discussed this for years with our Russian friends, is that these ultra-nationalist neo-Nazi groups in Ukraine. And nobody in the West wants to talk about that. And as we come up to the anniversary of Victory Day here in Russia, because it's still celebrated and it's very important, the victory over fascism, the Russian public sees that it's fighting it again in the 21st century in a neighboring country. That's not reported in the West. Go ahead, Oliver.
Well, it's unfortunately, we've seen this also. We saw it in Russia. We've seen it in pretty much every international crisis in which the United States has been participant or has had an interest. And that is to say that there is a monolithic, monochromatic narrative that is spun by Western media. And for so long, and still today, unfortunately, most people in the West are beguiled by the myth that control of the media is always controlled by the state over the media, without recognizing that corporate-controlled media are just as problematic as state-controlled media. There are even times when state-controlled media are actually quite a bit more dependable than corporate-controlled media, because of the interest of corporate media in profit, in capturing eyeballs in order to sell them to advertisers. But there's much, much more than that going on when we ponder this phenomenon of Western subjugation to the foreign policies of Western governments. And you have to accept the fact that corporate media are part of much larger corporate empires whose continued acceptability to power depends on their being cooperative in spinning the kind of narratives that the bosses want.
Yeah, and the bosses war is very profitable here. Robert, I'm going to go to you in the last 30 seconds of the program. You know, there's the most people you hear very often, you know, most Americans didn't know where Ukraine was before this conflict started. I bet you my bottom dollar they still don't know where it is. What do you think, Robert?
Well, I think, Peter, before anybody posts an emoji Ukrainian flag on their social media account, they should at least be able to tell you several things, like what the Maidan uprising was, what was the Minsk Protocol, who was Stepan Bandera, the Ukrainian Nazi collaborator, who many of the people fighting now in Ukraine, for example, the Azov Battalion, seem to admire and honor. And that's why Russians are there right now, partially. And it is really terribly ironic that you have the May 9th celebrations coming up, and Russia basically finds itself on the stage fighting alone against who? The fascists. So okay. That's really a terrible irony of history.
A terrible irony to end the program, and I want to thank you, Robert, specifically for talking about context, which is absent in Western media. That's all the time we have, gentlemen. Many thanks to my guests in Toronto, Ojai, and here in Moscow. And thanks to our viewers for watching us here at RT. See you next time, and remember, Crosstalk rules.
This is called Talking John Birch Paranoid Blues. It's a fictitious story. Well, I was feeling sad and kind of blue. I didn't know what I was gonna do. The communists were coming around. They were in the air, they were on the ground, they were all over. So I ran down most hurriedly and joined the John Birch Society. I got me a secret membership card, went back to my backyard, and started looking on the sidewalk, beneath a rose bush. Well, I was looking everywhere for them gold darn reds. I got up in the morning, looked under my bed, looked behind the kitchen, behind the door, even tore loose the kitchen floor. I couldn't find any. I looked beneath the sofa, beneath the chair, looking for them reds everywhere. I looked way up my chimney hole, even deep down inside my toilet bowl. They got away. I heard some footsteps by the front porch door, so I grabbed my shotgun from the floor. I snuck around the house with a huff and a hiss, saying, "Hands up, you communist!" It was the mailman. He punched me out. Well, I quit my job so I could work alone. I got a magnifying glass like Sherlock Holmes. Following some clues from my detective bag, I discovered there was red stripes on the American flag.